welcome to the Dellingpod with me, James Dellingpod. And I know I always say I'm excited about this week's guest, this week's invisible guest, as you can see. You can just see my face, but not his. But before we find out who the invisible guest is, let's have a word from one of our sponsors, Sina Crisps. I used to eat loads and loads of crisps in my normie days, and then, of course, I discovered that they're all cooked in toxic seed oils, and so I pretty much gave up. The people behind Sina have come up with a brilliant idea of cooking crisps not in seed oils, but in coconut oil, so they're actually not harmful to you. And they also taste... good. Was that a good idea to eat my crisps in the middle of the advert? I'm not sure. Anyway, I just want to make something absolutely clear. Just because I'm starting to do crisp adverts doesn't mean I'm about to become the new Gary Lineker. That's a joke that will go completely over the head of non-British viewers, and I envy those who don't know who Gary Lineker is. They're organic, they are not ultra-processed food, no seed oils, and you can find them at www.sinacrisps, that's S for sugar, I-N-A, crisps.com.
Use the code James for 15% off your order.
So, again, I'm not Gary Lineker, and I envy those of you who don't know who Gary Lineker is. I'm advertising crisps, but they are good crisps. They taste good, and they're cooked in coconut oil. So check out Sina Crisps.
Use the code James, J-A-M-E-S, that's me, for 15% off your order.
Welcome back to the Dellingpod, Robert Frederick, a.k.a. The Hidden Life is Best. I'm a big fan of your work, Robert, and you've been very influential in helping shape my understanding of at least part of how the world works, particularly your research into Francis Bacon, and I suppose you'd call it elite Gnosticism.
Yes.
I think there's a lot in your theory, and we can talk about that again, because not everyone can be bothered to go back to the old podcasts. And I mean, if they're anything like me, I've forgotten what we said exactly. I mean, I know we talked about Romeo and Juliet, but let's not be too worried about repeating ourselves. And maybe you can talk to me about Rosicrucianism as well, because
sure.
That's a thing I've never really. What is it? What's all that about? You think that was invented by Francis Bacon too, if I'm right?
Yes, I'm 100% convinced of that.
Okay. But before we go on, and I thought I would I ran it by you before we started this podcast, because what I don't do is like springing stuff on my guests, or not unless it's going to be helpful and fun for them. But I don't believe it's my job to ambush my guests, to put them on the spot or make them feel uncomfortable, let alone knife them in the back, because I think people are much better when they're not on the back foot. And but I have to say, I was slightly taken aback by some of the things you wrote about me on Substack in response to an article I wrote called "Why We Can't All Get Along." And you don't mind reading them out, so we can discuss them briefly before we move on.
I don't mind at all, okay. And I'm really happy to be here. I'm kind of almost a little giddy. I'm honored that your words. I'm impressed that you invited me on after what I said. And also, you know your Shakespeare, and you knew Alexander Waugh.
And, yes,
and all,
he was
all
a very
of that
good friend
too.
Of mine.
Yeah, and I mean all of that. So I'm really happy to be here. A tad embarrassed, but why should I be? I was.
No, it's fine.
It's the new me. I'm not afraid of confrontation. So you wrote an essay called "Why Can't We All Get Along?"
Yeah.
And I fired back. I'd say you created the need for this tedious baffle gab by victimizing on yourself, loudly proclaiming the earth is a floating pancake. Oh, right. And JFK faked his assassination. Oh, and there is no virus, no how, no way. And you gave Yeadon Incorporated a platform to tell the world that ivermectin causes infertility. With no footnotes. Not a good look. Perhaps the coup de grace was the tongue bath you gave Ike a while back. Maybe you are from the same department. Can't prove it. So just saying. And I didn't even have the decency to sign off.
And well, no. And then I said, "Oh, I'm sorry to hear this," right. Or something like that. Sad to hear this because I'm still a big fan of your work. And you carried on. So do you want to do the second bit?
James replies, "Yes, it's sad that some of my opinions seem to enrage you, but never mind. We always have a good podcast chat. We always have good podcast chats. Do you fancy doing another sometime?" And I reply twice. There's only one here.
I only want the angry one, not the one saying yes.
So the angry one is, "It isn't sad at all. You can't seriously believe in a floating pancake earth or that JFK faked his assassination. I think, sir, that you are lying." Whoa. "Or that ivermectin causes infertility, or that there is no way, no virus, no now, no how. You take establishment lies and magnify them into absurdity so that nothing seems to be real to your listeners besides that everything is fake and a lie. So let's turn on the D-pod. Toss in some scripture for affect and legitimacy. You appear to me to be 21st century Hamlet chaos agent, handing the keys to strong arm, while we are to feel sympathy for you, poor misunderstood you. Ha, ha, ha. It's preposterous and ridiculous, not sad. Keep pretending to be the sad one. Keep up your laments and cries. But I present that too is a lie. And when you puff that weed, you always let us know you puff. The laughter really begins." Mm. Ouch.
So obviously, when you read it in that voice, it sounds quite amusing. And I'm not at all offended by it. Well, I wasn't anyway. But so did you? There obviously was a degree of animus behind those posts. I mean, they're said with some feeling.
Yeah, I've been feeling it lately, particularly about no virus, particularly about flat earth, but also the JFK faked his assassination, which seems to be growing now. I think it's coming from that, what's his name, Miles Mathis.
I know you're you like to go big on detail, so can I just correct you on a couple of points?
Of course, please.
You made one is that I'm not sure that I think your recollection that I may have fellated David Icke couldn't be further from the truth.
Oh, okay.
David Icke and I had a very, very sticky encounter. It was a live podcast event in which I'd gone along thinking, yay, I'm going to meet the godfather of conspiracy. Well, he's not the godfather of conspiracy theorists, but in England, he has that kind of reputation. I'm going to meet this guy, and there's going to be this fantastic meeting of minds, and we're going to have a great conversation. And instead, it was this very turgid conversation. It was like going to a jukebox, and you press the button, and the needle goes slowly around, and it reaches the particular disc, and the disc won't stop playing until the end. There was no room for interruption. It was very tedious, and I realized there was no meeting of minds. There was no conversational dash. And I subsequently researched into David Icke, and I realized that he is not as presented, that he is Freemasonic, Gnostic, New Age, all sorts of things that I think are dangerous. And but anyway, so that's one of them. Okay. On the Kennedy faked his assassination front, No, it's not really where I am. I mean, I've heard the theory, and I don't want to rule anything out because I haven't looked into it fully. But I'm still of the he was killed by multiple assassins, or rather, I don't know whether they all might have to get a shot at him, but a team of assassins was put in place all over Dallas that day, including, I think, a guy that I was friendly with for a while, G. Gordon Liddy. I think he was part of the assassination team. So, I think I'm fairly conventional in my, on that conspiracy theory.
My mistake. Sorry.
What were the other ones you castigated for? The no virus thing, I sort of, I incline towards terrain, but it's not a hill I particularly want to die on, because I can see, as you've seen, that it becomes too much of a kind of, it attracts too many zealots who think that, that if only we can show that the virus doesn't exist, then the world will be changed. And I don't think it will be. I'm much more of a, all vaccination is bad in every form. It was always designed to be bad. I'm with Sasha Latipova on this one. I think the vaccination is pure evil, and anyone even countenancing it for any use whatsoever is a fool at this stage.
Agreed.
Flat Earth, yeah, I'm very skeptical of globe Earth model, but it's not something that I lie awake worrying about whether I'm right or wrong. It's just, I think it's, you're more likely than not that we're not living on a globe, but it's not something that that would, here I am talking to you, who somebody who believes passionately opposite. I don't think that it ought to be something that could, that should come between us. The weed thing. I think you're a bit behind the times, though. I don't really smoke much weed anymore, and I haven't for some time. I mean, you know, I might have the occasional puff, but it just seems to me that these are kind of angry slurs. I don't know.
Well, I'm sorry, I missed. It was only in our first interview where you mentioned the JFK. Really took me by surprise. You mentioned the flat Earth, so I thought those two were solid. I heard you talking about Ike in a way that was I thought was praiseworthy. I confess to not hearing that interview, but the way you spoke about him, I felt legitimized him when he's clearly
no. But also, don't forget, Robert, that one's views. I mean, we were all normies once, and then we started researching this stuff. And we're learning all the time.
I agree.
My views are changing, or certainly developing all the time, and attracting more neurons. Sometimes I reject old ideas of mine. Sometimes I sort of get different slants on them. And I just thought there was too much sort of angry dogmatism in your comments.
You're right.
Sort of unbecoming one of us.
I agree. I was too angry. I have been angry lately. Because I challenged the no virus crowd.
Yeah.
And I got a lot of comments, and I had to kind of steel myself to fire back while trying to stay polite. And some of them are, you know, they're not that intelligent, but you are clearly very intelligent. And the flat earth thing of all of them is the most easy to show someone is wrong. I have two pretty good friends that are flat earthers, and a third I know. I never talked to her about it. She lives in another country. I just heard she was now a flat earther. And I have two friends that I've spoken to in detail, and I now like thinking I can't persuade anyone to change their mind, because as you no doubt know, as we found out during COVID, all the evidence in the world won't change someone who's for some reason got a motivated belief. Which I understand more for COVID, because they've created the religion of scientism that so many of us unconsciously believe, and vaccines are the saint of scientism. So people were scared of the virus, and they couldn't accept any evidence you gave them that would make them think the government was lying and science was doing bad things. But flat Earth is a different category, because it's they're not gaining anything. The enemy is not gaining power or money or influence or anything by tricking us about the shape of the earth, except for the few who say, well, it's biblical. The Bible says the earth is flat and doesn't move. And so I looked into it. Nowhere does it say the earth is flat in the Bible.
No, it doesn't.
But it does say the earth doesn't move.
The, So, yes, I think I'm not ducking the issue. I don't think that it would be fruitful for us to dwell on this particular subject.
No, it's fine.
We're not going to agree, and it'll just be he said. So what I do want to talk about you about is this overarching view of the world, which we very much have in common, which is that, I mean, this is the thing that most interests me, actually, because my interest is really in art and culture and how people's thinking is shaped by the system.
Me too. Yeah.
And this is where we both align, I think, that a very narrow, powerful elite rules over us through really mind control. Alchemy, you've talked about.
Yeah.
Language, obviously, the literature. And I suppose we ought to maybe start with the Shakespeare project, which I think you've argued is partly about sort of mind control and partly about sort of world domination by creating a new empire. Is that fair?
That's very fair. Yes.
So tell me how it works briefly. So a sort of recap of the process.
I see Francis Bacon as someone who wanted to build an empire. And he certainly wasn't the first person in England to say that or want that. And it was in the air. You know, Drake and Hakluyt and Raleigh and Dee and Elizabeth herself had this desire, and Bacon saw how to make it happen from the ground up. And this, by the way, this desire for empire is shot through Bacon's philosophical writings, and people have started to notice it recently. Biographies of Bacon keep coming out, by the way. His interest in him is rising. It kind of troughed.
How many of them suggest that he was the son of Elizabeth I?
None of them. None of the normie biographies say he was the son. There's a few. There's this Gene Overton, who wrote a very in-depth Bacon biography. I have it out over there. What's her name? Daphne du Maurier.
Oh, did she as well?
Yeah, she's totally onto him as Shakespeare. And there's the Baconian biographies of Bacon that are 100% into him as Shakespeare. But they all praise him for it. They don't see the negative side of Shakespeare. They don't see the negative side of Freemasonry. So they think of him as a god. So you've got these Baconians who worship Bacon. Then you've got the sober history of ideas people who take Bacon's ideas seriously because they know what a phenomenal impact his ideas had on intellectual history. So there are these two camps, and I'm sort of taking the one, the history of intellectual ideas, and combining it with the Baconian camp, but I'm very negative. I think Shakespeare was a tremendously negative influence on humanity. And that's part of the fascination, is that he's praised everywhere, all around the world, and every university has a Shakespeare department. You can get PhDs in Shakespeare in the United States. And the praise is just relentless. And I'm starting to track it almost like you can't criticize Shakespeare because then you're a Philistine, you're a dummy, you don't get it, you're too dumb.
Well, I was thinking about that before we started this podcast today. And I was thinking how totally this aligns with the Gnostic process, whereby the Gnostics believe that, well, as Bacon said, knowledge is power. Or what was his exact quotation?
The exact is Knowledge itself is power.
Knowledge itself is power. So that really, it's an elite preoccupation that only it is given only to the few to acquire this information about how the world works and its secrets. And once you have acquired these secrets, which only an elect will ever gain access to, you have the power and the right to rule the world. That's roughly how it goes, isn't it?
100%. Yeah. Like, how Gnostic is that?
And in the same way, Shakespeare, the works of Shakespeare are almost like their Bible, or that if you want to be part of the elite, you've got to be intimately familiar with the works of Shakespeare and be able to quote him and really think he's great. And then you're on the top table.
100%. And if you want to make it in Hollywood, you've got to do Shakespeare.
Yeah.
I can't think of any really famous actors that haven't done Shakespeare except for Tom Cruise. he had another route to stardom.
Yeah, he did.
They all do it, and they all continue to do it. So many. Some make a career of it, as you know.
Yeah, Kevin Spacey, I think, was very big on Shakespeare, wasn't he?
Oh, Spacey. What did he do? So many of them are. I'm drawing a blank right now because it's literally all of them.
Yeah.
Leo DiCaprio did Romeo and Juliet as a
Romeo
very young
plus
guy.
Juliet as he. Yeah, I really fancied Claire Danes in that. I'm not sure I do anymore.
Oh, it's so awful. That movie is so
Yeah, but
awful.
it had Radiohead on the soundtrack. To make it relevant. And yeah, you're right, though. The fact that all these very, very, very dodgy people are so immersed in Shakespeare and must perform his work, it's like performing an occult ritual, isn't it?
100%. I think they are. I think the plays are rituals. I really do. There's a depth of knowledge of humanity and psychology that's really, really profound going on in these plays, that they can be the inversion. They can be appear to be the inversion of what they really are. So powerfully. And the use of language is so powerful and so strong. And it is undeniable. And they are freakishly brilliant works. They're not all great plays. They're not all necessarily great art. But the amount of references and allusions and classical, you know, learning and historical learning and psychological learning is shocking. And to this day, books are being written about the plays that have new interpretations based on close readings that become undeniable. It's like, that's definitely in there. And nobody saw it for 400 years. And that keeps happening. And there's so many ways to go with this that my mind just popped into alchemy. Like, it just happened about, what's the date? Like 1989, someone wrote a book about alchemy in the works of Ben Jonson, John Donne, and even Francis Bacon. And they missed Shakespeare, but now it's like every play can be interpreted alchemically, and books are coming out about the alchemy in Shakespeare. And one woman just wrote a book about the sonnets, how the sonnets are drenched in alchemy. And it's undeniably true, and that's quite astonishing, because alchemy is Gnostic. And alchemy is that desire to control the world and knowledge and to gain special knowledge. They were seeking special knowledge of the secrets of the universe, secrets of nature, so they could live forever. And in my opinion, you know, conquer God, conquer the creator. And it's all there in the plays, which continually astonishes me. And I don't know which way you want to go with this, because
we could go in any direction.
I don't know.
Well, here's a counterfactual. Do you think if Francis Bacon hadn't been born and the Elizabethan court hadn't been what it was, do you think Britain would ever have had an empire?
No, no, no way. Because Bacon also created Freemasonry. And one of the reasons the Shakespeare plays are so big is because of Freemasonry. The Freemasons see the alchemy and the Masonic symbolism, and they know that a brother wrote that play, and they are bound by blood oath to promote that play. And they promote it, they act in it, they teach it, they advertise it, they write reviews of it. And that's one reason Shakespeare got so big, and all the early promoters of Shakespeare, really big names like Boswell and Johnson and Pope. Alexander Pope was a Freemason. He loved Shakespeare. And, you know, he's a fantastic guy, Pope. In fact, he's kind of an anti-Gnostic. But he promoted Shakespeare endlessly, you know, before it was fashionable. And I see that as part of why Shakespeare's so big, why England got the desire for empire, because it's in those plays, as we spoke about last time. We spoke about that famous speech by John of Gaunt in This Sceptred Isle.
It is my favorite speech.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it's amazing poetry, and it just stirs you. And Bacon, what I understand to be what Bacon saw is that England needed a national poet. They needed a great, great poet, as the Greeks had Homer and the Romans had Virgil. It was extremely important to them, because Bacon understood what poetry is and how powerful it was. And that's really where the Brits excelled. I mean, the poetry of that period is incredible.
Yeah, I think we possibly touched on this before, this idea that
Brit genius.
Words are a form of magic. They're a form of spell.
100%.
And the reason that poets so love themselves and think it's their God-given right to shag loads and loads of women, and why Baudelaire describes himself as an albatross, sort of the poet Moody flying above the world, and kind of like almost a kind of Christ-like figure.
I'm sorry, I lost you there for a minute.
Mine will be recorded. Riffing on the idea.
Yeah, poets, words are magic.
They love
poets
themselves. Because they're conscious of the power that they have to weave these spells.
Yes.
Because it is the logos, isn't it? Yes.
Yes, and it's the basis of hypnosis. And they studied rhetoric and sophistry.
Which is a bastard. It's a horrible thing, rhetoric, isn't it? I mean, clever thing, but it's malign, and it's really, it's not a moral thing at all.
Yeah, it's immoral. And that line, though, between art and beauty and undue influence on others is very narrow, but Bacon intentionally sought influence through his writing, and they knew this about poetry. Philip Sidney wrote an Apologia for Poetry in defense of poetry, and he comes out and says nearly literally that poetry is alchemy, that poets can change the world. Even says that poets are greater than nature, because
somebody said all poetry is feigning. Was that?
That's Bacon.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like they're telling you.
Yeah.
It's all artifice. It's all fake. It's all lies.
Yeah. Well, it's not lies, but you know, that goes back to Plato. Plato wanted to ban poetry from the ideal city because he saw that you can't have an ideal city if you've got these poets running around telling stories. And he even denigrated art and painting as not close enough, not reality. But this idea that something's wrong with nature and we're better than nature is part of Gnosticism. And nature needs to be fixed, which is part of Scientism. And that poetry can be that. Poetry itself is alchemy. And I think that's what Bacon got. That's where Bacon was actually very original.
Did these people...
He didn't need a cauldron. He needed words.
Did these people yet... The Elizabethan court, I mean, we're talking about a period where it was illegal not to go to church.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth made her speech about window to men's souls and all that. And they talk about God a lot. Do you think this was all fakery, or do you think they did believe that they were Christians while yet being Gnostics?
It could be, because you can. That's part of Gnosticism, but I think it was Machiavellian. I think they were. It was mostly pretend.
Do you? I mean, is that just a surmise, or do you have any kind of?
I really do think it was. It was mostly fake, and I think they were carrying on doing all kinds of dark deeds. It's in Midsummer Night's Dream. It's in Hamlet. It's in Macbeth. And like nobody prays in the Shakespeare plays. And your friend Alexander Waugh said, you know, it was illegal to talk about religion in the plays, but it wasn't illegal to show someone praying to Jesus Christ. But nobody does. It's like that's part of the deep suggestion and power of suggestion is what's not there.
Isn't there a scene in Hamlet where he's praying? And
there's one there. There's one scene there where Claudius is praying, and Hamlet doesn't kill him because he's praying. So it's in a way that scene is just there to show like how evil Hamlet is. That he doesn't kill Claudius because he realizes if he kills him while he's praying, his soul's going to go to heaven. So he's going to kill him when he's not praying, so his soul goes to hell.
Yes, you're right, Hamlet.
Hamlet. So dark.
Yeah.
So dark.
So give me your gloss on Hamlet, because you're right. It's like
so
all
dark.
Shakespeare.
Like this almost is all Shakespeare. He'll cover it. You know, everything's always covered. There's always, like, there's Portia's beautiful speech about love in Merchant of Venice, which everyone remembers when they think of Shakespeare. It's love, you know, mercy that drops from
quality
heaven.
Quality of mercy is not strained. Well, that's it.
Yeah. That's it. And that you think of, but that's pretty much it. And that's how they veil the reality with these things that you latch onto, because that's how the mind works. You fill in the gaps. Like Shakespeare's good, so where's the, you know, you instantly recall these good speeches like that. And with Hamlet, he literally comes out and says, Denmark is a prison. And his two best friends that he later has killed say, no, we think not, my lord. And he goes, well, it's not a prison for you. I say the world is a prison. And that's literally the Gnostic credo. Some goodly, I could call up the quote here, but he says the world is a prison. Some a goodly prison, some better, some worse, but Denmark is the worst. And it doesn't fit his character because he was free to go back to college. He was supposed to go back to Wittenberg. He was in college at the time. And he didn't go because his parents begged him not to. We need you to stay home, which kind of doesn't make sense either if he's acting so crazy. Like, get him out. Send him back to college. So he's free, but he calls the world a prison for no good reason, because it's Gnostic. In fact, he is a symbolism of humanity as a Gnostic sees humanity. Someone who's denied their proper kingship, their proper place, their divine. And why wasn't he chosen as king? He's the son of the king. The king died. He should be king. He was denied that. And so he's seething with indignation and grievance. You know, Gnosticism is the ultimate grievance trip. And that's Hamlet. He's just really been out of shape. Okay, his father got killed. Well, his father's dead. He doesn't even know he got killed. The ghost tells him that. So he's just really been out of shape that his father died. And of course, he's really mad at his mother, Gertrude, for marrying his uncle, which in some circles is sort of thought of as incest, but of course it's not incest. But he really hates his mother for bringing, you know, just in general, Gnostics hate women because women bring new life into the world. And they forbade intercourse.
Is that right? Is that a common trait in Gnosticism?
Yeah, they promote homosexuality because they don't want to bring new life into the world. So he's embodying all these traits of Gnosticism. He brutalizes Ophelia, another woman, which is common throughout Shakespeare. The brutalization of women in Shakespeare is completely off the scale, with a few examples to not make it so obvious. But, one woman in Shakespeare, I forget her name, in Titus Andronicus, she has her hands cut off and her tongue ripped out after she's raped.
Livia?
I forget her name. And she carries on that way for most of the play. Very graphically and very right in front of your face. It's just awful. And women will rationalize and say, oh, he's telling you about the status of women in society, but he's really not. He could say that. He could show that in the plays if he wanted, but he doesn't. He shows you these really horrible things that happen to women. I've got a list of them somewhere. But to get back to Hamlet, he states the Gnostic Credo. He acts the Gnostic Credo, and the ghost tells him that he was murdered and to avenge his murder. Which is very weird because the ghost is having his soul purified in purgatory by also what he said. And there's a brilliant book from the 1970s by Eleanor Prosser called Hamlet and Revenge, where she does a deep reading of the things the ghost says and the things the ghost does according to Elizabethan belief system at the time. And she proves that it's not a ghost, it's a demon. And Hamlet suspected it was a demon. And that, in fact, Hamlet is possessed of a demon. And this demon wants him to commit murder. And the language is so convoluted and intense and profound, you know, the speeches, such a piece of work as man, and to be or not to be, all that stuff. It's just endless. Like Hamlet is quoted more than any Shakespeare play. It's so quotable that you're pulled in to this world of Hamlet where he's just a vicious, vicious young man who loves nobody and nothing except Horatio. He's homosexual. He torments Ophelia so badly that she kills herself, and he slobbers all over Horatio in one scene. You'll see this if you watch the Kenneth Branagh. The only way to see the entire Hamlet, which is 4 hours long, it's always cut. Not Kenneth Branagh. He did the whole thing. It's excellent, actually. It's he pulls it up to like 1800s, so there's no technology, but it's not, you know, medieval or Renaissance. And there's a scene where he's talking to Horatio, his only friend, and he practically starts making out with him, and he goes, "Oh, I better stop." Because that's really the only person he loves. And then just to cut to the end of the play, after this incredible bloodbath, Horatio says to him, and this is what everyone remembers, "Good night, sweet prince. May flocks of angels see thee to thy rest." He was no sweet prince. He was a total asshole the entire play. His mother thought he was going to kill her. He badgers Ophelia to death. He kills Polonius. He kills Ophelia's brother. He basically destroys the kingdom. And here's the hidden upshot of it. There's this, which you'll only see in the Branagh version. There's a subplot of Fortinbras from Norway has asked permission to march through Denmark to go to Poland to fight the Poles for whatever reason. And that's a whole speech. And he goes, "Wow, these soldiers can go to Poland and fight. And like, I can't even kill my uncle, but they can just go fight for a square piece of land. Like, what's up with that?" And Fortinbras then is coming back from Poland at the end of the play. He shows up in the bloodbath. And Hamlet goes, I see the election lights on Fortinbras. In other words, Fortinbras is now king. Fortinbras means strong arm. Fuerte brazo. So he has destroyed the kingdom and handed the key of the kingdom to strong arm, which is exactly Bacon's philosophy, that the king needs to be strong, and it's a Bacon secretary, Thomas Hobbes. You need a strong
ruler. It's also
ruler.
Ordo ab chaos.
100%. And that runs throughout the Shakespeare plays, order ab chaos. All the tragedies, Iago, Macbeth, they're almost like teaching methods, like how to do it. Here's how you do it, guys. And Hamlet's a hero, right? He's kind of heroic.
Well, isn't that interesting in itself, Robert? That I mean, whenever there's a new Hamlet staged in London, yeah, all the critics get big in their trousers, and they, it's the sort of the benchmark for an up and coming new actor. When has he done Hamlet? Well, this is the launch pad for his career, and hours are spent in schools and some schools, not many these days, but English departments of universities analyzing Hamlet's speeches and stuff. And yet, as you say, very few people, are, hang on, sorry, I'm just bashing my microphone.
Yeah, I lost you there at universities.
I'm just wondering why my microphone's, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Are saying, hang on a second, this guy is a, he's a psychopath.
Yeah, they're finally seeing it. It's finally being seen.
Is it?
Yeah, finally.
He's not just a confused, typical adolescent, you know, that asks the big questions. He's an absolute.
He's a psycho. Yeah, he kills his best friends. He has them murdered. It's crazy.
I mean, sometimes people sort of express a certain sort of squeamishness about the deaths of Rosencrantz and Guildens. I mean, the callous way he just has them.
Oh yeah,
bumped off. But
people noticed it, but they weren't allowed to say it somehow. Like there was a self censorship, and someone would always jump to his defense. You can find it. I've been reading historical Shakespeare scholarship, and there's always someone there to jump to the defense of Hamlet or the plays themselves, and they'll just kind of convince you, like, yeah. You know, he was too smart. He was, what's the Laurence Olivier version of Hamlet was the story of a man who couldn't make up his mind. I mean, no, this is a story of a demon possessed homosexual serial killer who destroys the kingdom.
Yes.
That's what it is.
Do you know what? If only we'd had this conversation before I went up to my university to read English, I think, I tell you what, my tutor would have loved it. He would have absolutely, this would have been meat and drink to him, because he was always a fish out of water. He never bought into all the kind of conventional crap. He was a genius. And it would have certainly have enlivened our tutorials, because it's...
Yes, yes.
Bear with us. It's got to be done. Another book plug from James.
Global warming is a massive con. There is no evidence whatsoever that man-made climate change is a problem, that it's going to kill us, that we need to amend our lifestyle in order to deal with it. It's a non-existent problem. But how do you explain this stuff to your normie friends? Well, I've just brought out the revised edition, my 2012 classic book, Watermelons, which captures the story of how some really nasty people decided to invent the global warming scare in order to fleece you, to take away your freedoms, to take away your land. It's a shocking story. I wrote it, as I say, in 2011 actually, the first edition came out. And it's a snapshot of a particular era. The era when the people behind the climate change scam got caught red-handed, tinkering with the data, torturing till it screamed, in a scandal that I helped christen ClimateGate. So I give you the background to the skullduggery that went on in these seats of learning where these supposed experts were informing us, we've got to act now. I rumbled their scam. I then asked the question, okay, if it is a scam, who's doing this and why? It's a good story. I've kept the original book pretty much as is, but I've written two new chapters, one at the beginning and one at the end, explaining how it's even worse than we thought. I think it still stands up. I think it's a good read. Obviously I'm biased, but I'd recommend it. You can buy it from jamesdellingpole.co.uk/shop. You'll probably find that one. Just go to my website and look for it, jamesdellingpole.co.uk. And I hope it helps keep you informed and gives you the material you need to bring round all those people who are still persuaded that, oh, it's a disaster, we must amend our ways and appease the gods, appease Mother Gaia. No, we don't. It's a scam.
Now, back to the Delling Pod.
He has them murdered. It's crazy.
I mean, sometimes people sort of express a certain sort of squeamishness about the deaths of Rosencrantz and Guildens. I mean, the callous way he just has them.
Oh yeah,
bumped off. But
people noticed it, but they weren't allowed to say it somehow. Like there was a self censorship, and someone would always jump to his defense. You can find it. I've been reading historical Shakespeare scholarship, and there's always someone there to jump to the defense of Hamlet or the plays themselves. And they'll just kind of convince you, like, yeah, you know, he was too smart. He was, what's the Laurence Olivier version of Hamlet was the story of a man who couldn't make up his mind. I mean, no. This is a story of a demon-possessed homosexual serial killer who destroys the kingdom.
Yes.
That's what it is.
Do you know what? If only we'd had this conversation before I went up to my university to read English. I think, I tell you what, my tutor would have loved it. He would have absolutely, wow. This would have been meat and drink to him, because he was always a fish out of water. He never bought into all the kind of conventional crap. He was a genius. And it would have certainly have enlivened our tutorials, because it's...
Yes, yes. I mean, it's, plus it's there. Everyone recognizes the antithesis in the Shakespeare plays. So no honest scholar could deny that it's hinted at. It's certainly there, but they'll always override it with, you know, some, you know, rationalization. They always have a scholar ready to prop Shakespeare back up who's given prominent place. And you're like, yeah, it must, yeah, he's just, yeah, he just couldn't make up his mind. Yeah. Well. The Presser book is really great. It shows that it was a demon, which he thought it was. That's phenomenal. And there's one of your countrymen, a guy named N.M. Gwynn. He's a Latin scholar.
Oh, yeah. Yes, Gwynn's compendium.
Yeah, oh, you talked about that. Yeah. He's one of the very few that builds a sustained case against Shakespeare. Although I am remembering Colin Wilson, English writer.
Yeah.
I read one of his books when I was a kid called The Outsider. I think it was his first book, and I think he wrote it when he was very young. And this stuck in my head. He goes, I don't like Shakespeare. He goes, the characters are all so immature. They're all so, and it's true, like King Lear, like what a goofy guy to do that. The whole premise of King Lear is so goofy. So Colin Wilson maybe stuck that in my head. And I never studied Shakespeare at college. So I was never talked about him in this saintly way. And I always, as someone who loves literature and its influence on the world, I was just like, I need to learn my Shakespeare. I want to know what it means when someone says he's an Iago, he's a real Iago, or she's a real Lady Macbeth. I need to know what that means. And I went into Shakespeare fresh.
Yeah. I think we need to be careful not to overstate our case, in as much as, although I agree with you, there are all these kind of dodgy things about Shakespeare.
We cannot
dismiss him, the Bacon and his De Vere and the rest of the creative team.
Yeah.
We cannot dismiss them as hacks. I mean, we're talking about high level of artistry.
Extreme genius. There's extreme genius just to promulgate the hoax, to create the hoax and pull it off the way it did is remarkable. You know, they had Ben Jonson, who was legit. He was a legit playwright who doesn't seem to be that patriotic, who kind of straddles the fence, but he was heavily involved. And then this time, you want to talk about Rosicrucianism, it ties into that because Bacon created the Rosicrucian hoax too at the same time. In fact, the Rosicrucian hoax happened just before the first folio came out. And
can you just outline very briefly what the Rosicrucian hoax was?
Rosicrucian hoax consisted of two pamphlets that came out in 1614 and 1615 called the Fama Confessio, the Fama Fraternitatis, the famous brotherhood, Fama Fraternitatis. And it spoke of a man named Christian Rosenkreutz and his travels and what he had learned, particularly in the Middle East, and how he had started a brotherhood, an invisible college of learning that was to aid the world. And that the world, this literally starts with the world trumpeting, the world is on the cusp of change. And within it, it says the Rosicrucians are going to end old age and disease. So right there, you kind of get that Gnostic denial of death or hatred of that they have to die. This idea that we're lesser than God, which is all that separates us from God in the old days, because the gods were like men, or we're made in God's image, that the gods never die. Humans have to die. And that's part of that deep resentment. That we have to die. And so modern science is all about cheating death. And that's what alchemy was about with the Philosopher's Stone. And that's the first sentence of, no, it's not the first sentence, but it's the first sentence is the world is on the cusp of change. And it was true. Like right then, like Bacon knew. He knew, he called himself the herald of a new time. And he was, and he predicted it. And 10 years later, New Atlantis came out, which is the first conception of a technocracy, a society run on science. It's literally come true. And he knew, and it was a complete hoax. There was no Christian Rosenkreutz. There was no literal invisible college. Although there definitely were, I'm sure, a loose affiliation of a sort of a nascent secret society of people opposed to the church, people doing alchemy in particular. And it even says, we're going to do Kabbalah and magic and alchemy, Christian Rosenkreutz. And the pamphlet set particularly France on fire, Germany on fire. People were like, what is this? We need to find these people. I want to be a Rosicrucian. And it had this huge impact. And people were writing about it. People were claiming they were Rosicrucians. People were talking about finding the Rosicrucians. People were accused of being a Rosicrucian like Descartes. But they never, ever found a Rosicrucian. And it just slowly died out. But a woman named Frances Yates, who's a tremendous scholar from England, discovered the occult underbelly of the Renaissance. Coming through Italy and the books on Hermes and the Hermetic dialogues and Kabbalah and, of course, Platonism reemerged. And it all came into Florence with Pico de Mirandola and Marsilio Ficino. And from there, percolated up to England, and everybody became fascinated with this kind of new learning, and it culminated in the Rosicrucian Enlightenment. And that's a great, great book, Frances Yates, The Rosicrucian Enlightenment. And she all but says, probably was Francis Bacon wrote these. She can't quite go that far, but she makes a case that nobody else. And when you learn Bacon's writings, when you read his philosophical writings, it's very clear they're very similar to what's in the Rosicrucian manifestos and what Bacon wanted.
I was struck by two thoughts as you were saying all this. One is, weirdly enough, before you said the word that came into my head was Florence, because I was in Florence last year, I think, or the year before.
Lucky you.
And I went to that big garden, whatever it's called, where there's lots of grotto. Well, I think the first grottos were built in those gardens, and it is clear, looking at those grottos and looking at the symbolism of the grottos, for example, the use of owls, which is a sort of dark occult symbol, that these great Florentine noble families were pretending to be Christians, but were very evidently not. They were really enthralled to the dark side. And I think I share your suspicions about the Elizabethan court, that they paid lip service to Christianity as one had to get along. And I suppose the ordinary people thought they were living in a Christian country ruled by a Christian monarch. And there would have been trouble if the secret had got out. But probably behind the scenes, they were doing what the black nobility and the royals do now, which is participate in these extremely dark rituals.
I agree. As soon as the Freemasons became above ground, the Hellfire Clubs also became visible. And one of the Freemason clubs was run by, Hellfire Clubs was run by the Grand Master of English Freemasonry. Is it Walpole? I don't have the name in front of me. It's just really weird
not Robert Walpole. He was the Prime Minister.
He was a good one. What's the other one? There's another guy who ran the Hellfire Clubs who was also the Grand Master of Freemasonry.
Was Francis Dashwood.
He was Dashwood. That's it. Dashwood. He was a Freemason. And it's just weird that it came to light at the same time, and that not more was made of it at the time. I think they disbanded the Hellfire Club, and then he became Grand Master of Freemasonry. It's very, very, very odd. But yeah, they were doing all that stuff. They were carrying on, but it was, you know, it was a rules for thee, not for me.
Yeah.
And I think you see it in the Shakespeare plays, particularly A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Do you know, I was about to ask you that, so I'm glad you segued so beautifully into it. I mean, there's some really dark stuff, isn't there?
Oh, Midsummer Night's Dream is centered, the central image, because it's dreamlike, which is pretty amazing, because there's not a lot of quotes from A Midsummer Night's Dream. There's two or three, but there is a central image, just like a dream, where we dream in images of bestiality, of a woman having sex with an animal, which is understated in the play, but it's there. And the modern directors run with it and basically graphically portray a woman having sex with an animal, or a half man, half animal, to be exact. And in fact, the 1988 Michelle Pfeiffer, Kevin Kline vehicle, Midsummer Night's Dream, it's like really graphic. They just go with it. Now, in the old days, it was either cut out, or it was, you know, fade to black. Or it was just, oh, she loves her donkey. I'm going to put flowers in his hair. And it played on, like, we all love our animals and we hug our animals. But in this play, they have sex, and they have sex for a particular reason. And that's because her husband, in a play ostensibly about marriage, there's only one married couple, and that's the king and queen of the fairies. Oberon, king of the fairies, is determined to take away a little boy from Titania. This is all straight up. It's a key plot point of the play. And Titania won't give him the little boy. She's promised a votress who died in childbirth that she'll take care of his little boy. Don't you worry. Now, Oberon wants the little boy of unspecified age, but young. And she won't give him up. So what does Oberon do? He mind controls her and puts her through a sex trauma ritual, or sexual trauma. He puts a drug in her eyes, the magic flower, while she's sleeping, and intones in her in hypnotic language that she's to fall in love with some beastie and give him, like, extreme love, or some terms that suggest, like, you're going to give this beast all your love. I don't have the exact words in front of me. And sure enough, she wakes up and there's the donkey man who was transformed by Puck. So Puck and Oberon are a team. And she instantly falls in love with him because she has a magic spell put on her. And all she wants to do is have sex with this thing. And they drag it out and it gets laughs. And then they, you know, lights out in the bower. She tells all her fairies, leave us alone, leave us alone. Lights out in the bower. And long story short, Oberon winds up getting the little boy for unspecified reasons. And it's never said, like, how we fill in the blanks, how Bacon knew the human mind so well. We'll fill in the blank and say, well, it was time for that little boy to get away from his mom and become a man and grow up and learn the ways of men. But Oberon never says that. And Puck says Oberon wants him to be his, not hatchet man, wants him to be his, oh God, I'm forgetting the exact term, but it's never spelled out why Oberon wants the little boy. And and it's created an incredible quarrel between these two, who are like gods, like it messes up the weather really bad and they're quarreling. So long story short, she gives up the little boy off scene. A lot of stuff in Shakespeare happens off stage because it would be really hard to write this scene where Oberon finally convinces Titania to give him the little boy. And you never see the little boy, but it's a central plot point. So it implies pedophilia, and it portrays bestiality. And then there's a lot of homosexuality portrayed, particularly in the Rude Mechanicals when they do Pyramus and Thisbe. It's very graphic, which I could have the exact language.
It's explicitly homosexual, is it?
The Pyramus and Thisbe. Meanwhile, it makes fun of Romeo and Juliet because it's a charming double suicide that is played for laughs, because the Rude Mechanicals are so goofy doing this double suicide. And then the ladies again are tormented, and these two best friends that women, female Shakespeare lovers point to, what are the names again? Helena and, oh gosh, Diana Rigg plays Helena, and Helen Mirren plays, what's her name? They're best friends. And in the middle of the play, they want to rip each other's eyes out. So they're really degraded. The women are degraded and the men are made to look like fools. And the Rude Mechanicals are made to look like fools. And it's all a long initiation. And at the end of the play, the four young lovers are subdued. Titania's completely in Oberon's power. And they've been put through a ritual that brings peace to the city. So all of this stuff, especially Romeo and Juliet, is designed as kind of an underhanded, hidden or occult method of keeping peace, because the young lovers were running away. These young aristocrats were running away from the city because it was kind of too strict.
Ritually sacrificed.
Now they've been ritually humiliated. They've been humiliated.
Well, they die in Romeo and Juliet, so there's more than
in Romeo and Juliet, they're ritually sacrificed.
Yes.
And in Midsummer Night's Dream, they're ritually humiliated. And right. In both cases, peace comes to the city. And in both cases, the humiliation and sacrifice is carried out in a hidden way by a hidden arm of the government. And in Midsummer Night's Dream, all the scholars point this out, that Oberon and Titania are Theseus and Hippolyta, shadow side. They're king and queen and king and queen. And the levels of meaning are so profound because Theseus was the first king of Athens, and Theseus is the great hero of Greek myth who slayed the Minotaur. And the Minotaur came about as a result of bestiality when King Minos's wife got cursed by Poseidon to fall in love with a bull, and Daedalus made a fake bull for her to get into, a fake cow, so the bull could mate with her. And that's how the Minotaur was born, who ate children. So in a way, it's showing like the end of human sacrifice. Like the Minotaur had to eat like 7 Athenian children every 7 years. And Theseus put a stop to that. And he's the king of the play. He's Duke, but they call him Duke because it's really taking place in London. It's set in mythic time of kind of prehistory Athens, just before prehistory Athens. Theseus is thought to be the first king of Athens. Plutarch wrote, you know, a biography of him as an actual king, but he's mythical. And that's why this play is so unbelievably brilliant, is that it blends mythic time with historical time and blends a dreaming logic with an everyday logic.
Well,
just remarkable.
Why is the play so popular? I mean, or why are we
funny. People laugh at it, and it's a way to get kids into it because it's got fairies
and Harry Potter.
Yeah, and it's joking and it's funny, and the kids do it. My son did it in 7th grade. I didn't think anything of it. You don't notice. You just don't notice, and it's hiding in plain sight. It's freakish, which is the principle of steganography, which is a whole system of cryptography. It's literally hiding in plain sight, which the Freemasons do with their symbols. You know, they put a triangle and an eye up. Now we all know what that means, but 100 years ago when they put that on the dollar bill, no one knew what it meant, and no one cared, but every Freemason knew exactly what it was.
So well, you're also presumably familiar with the concept of masterful speaking.
I guess that would be, I've never heard that, but that would be what this is, yeah.
Masterful speaking is essentially saying things which mean different things to the sacred and the profane. So your brethren on the square will understand all the symbolism going on. I mean, so I imagine the initiated would know that this is about pedophilia, bestiality.
That's exactly it. And that,
but the profane, even, the ordinary punters.
Well, no, I won't even notice it. They don't even notice it. They take their kids to see it. Their kids be in it. I let my kid be in it. I didn't even notice. Of course, it's kids doing it.
When it came out, I mean, we know that Shakespeare.
Okay, I looked into it.
Did you?
I did, because my mind was so blown. It's like, I'm going to find out about this. I'm going to find out what people said about this play, because somebody must have noticed. You have to notice. There it is. Nobody noticed for a long, long time because they would censor it. They would take out the really saucy bits. Shakespeare historically has been heavily censored until the modern era. And no critics noticed it. Or if they did, they would even like defend it or rationalize it. Some critics used to say, well, Titania didn't give up the little boy to her husband. She's a disrespectful wife. So that's The 1700s. First of all, nobody watched Shakespeare in the 1600s hardly because there was the Civil War. And they didn't start putting the plays on until the late 1600s. And there wasn't really no such thing as criticism hardly. So the criticism begins in the 1700s. Although if you want to get into the weeds, you know, somebody wrote in their diary, you know, in 1620 that they saw the play. So you can really trace this stuff. Shakespeare scholars love this. They love tracing every word ever written about A Midsummer Night's Dream, and you can read it. And fast forward, like, nobody talks about it. It was censored. Some of the stuff was too racy. Some of the stuff was, other stuff was too sexual. Some of the stuff they just don't even notice. Some of the slang is antiquated, so they don't notice it. But if you fast forward and finally, I mean, literally, I must have spent 2 or 3 months reading criticism of Midsummer Night's Dream. And of course, you can buy the Arden Shakespeare. I think there's an Oxford Shakespeare on every single play. There are 300 page books analyzing, you know, just one play that make it easy for you. They'll write a 110 page essay on the play that is a survey of the history of criticism. And then they'll give you the link and you can go read the 1820 or whatever, 1920 G.K. Chesterton. G.K. Chesterton wrote on Midsummer Night's Dream. And you can read that.
What did he think? I mean, he was a Catholic.
I know. All he could do was praise Bottom. There's a character in Midsummer Night's Dream named Bottom. He's the one that's transformed into an ass.
Yeah.
Which we get to Apuleius and the Golden Ass, and he's initiated. And he's a really interesting scene. That's a genuinely funny scene. They do it great. If anyone wants to see the movie, the 1968 Midsummer Night's Dream, it's free on YouTube. Helen Mirren's in it. Diana Rigg.
Is this the Peter Brook one? No.
Peter Brook, the major Shakespeare director. Look for the Masonic symbolism that he puts in. Diana Rigg leans up against an obelisk at one point.
I mean, Helen Mirren is absolutely one of them. I mean,
she's done so much Shakespeare.
Well, yeah. She's done so much occult.
I'm sure. I didn't know that, but I'm sure. Yeah. She's such a big star. She's a huge star over here.
Yeah.
What was I saying?
You're saying the 68 version.
Yeah. If you want to see this, the 68 version, G.K. Chesterton talks about Bottom, who's the sidekick, transforms into an ass for no reason. But it's a nod to this famous novel. I think it's the first novel ever, Apuleius and the Golden Ass, where this guy is fooling around with magic in ancient Egypt and by mistake turns himself into a donkey. And he spends the novel as a donkey. It's borderline pornographic, but it's also a borderline, like, remarkable novel because it shows the world through how a donkey is treated in this world. And he gets in all kinds of scrapes and adventures, you know, it kind of leads from one story to another. It's quite brilliant. And then he gets initiated. If he can only eat roses, if he can eat roses, he'll transform back into a human being. So he spends the novel, you know, like seeing a rose and trying to bite the rose and it getting away from him. But then he winds up in Rome, where somehow, I forget, I've got the novel right here, he gets initiated into the mysteries of Isis, which is a proto... Isis actually by then was like a Virgin Mary. She was very pure. They shaved their heads. They wore robes. They disdained sex. They were very, very pure. And he joins that and changes his life. And in researchers into the mystery schools, that's the closest description they ever get of what it's like to be initiated into a mystery school, is Apuleius's Golden Ass. Yeah. And Bacon is referencing that by having the donkey have sex with a goddess the numinous goddess Titania, and there's all kinds of associations with Titania in that name, which is another name for Circe or Kirke, the magician. And then he is transformed. He's literally transformed in the play in a very famous speech where he bowdlerizes or garbles St. Paul's Corinthians 1 about man has neither eye to see nor ear to tell what happened to me tonight. And only a fool would try to explain what happened to me tonight. And I'll get Peter Quince to write a ballad about it. So he'll make art about it, but he can't tell anyone what happened to him. And in a way, he doesn't know what happened to him, but he just had spent the night with a goddess. And this is all like by act four. I mean, it's so deep, the play. And then they go to act five, where they act out the play within a play. And they start talking about the nature of reality. Like, what's real? Is a dream or is poetry real? What's more real? What's reality? It's all hinted at and, you know, keeps the scholars busy, but it's all in there. It's a deeply philosophical play. It's a comedy. It's, you know, it could be done pornographically. It's super crazy. And you might not even notice it. I mean, you'll watch this play and you wouldn't even notice it until you're, unless you're like me, you know, with the conspiracy ears. And I was watching it going, wait, why does Oberon want a boy?
Yeah.
And so, just to finish quickly, by the late 1900s, 1980s, 1990s, and early 2000s, yes, I found one scholar willing to admit that bestiality was referenced. I found a number of scholars to say it's pansexual. In fact, in the Peter Brook, I must have watched it five or six times, Oberon is pan. They put his hair up into horns. In the last scene, you see him, he's actually got goat legs. So, yeah, they do finally get there. By the year 2000, 400 years after the play was written, people can see what the play actually has in it. And that's crazy.
Two things. First of all, yep. Have you ever watched a comedy series called It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia?
No, is it good?
It's, well, I used to think it was amazing because it was offbeat and it was wacky and it's got Danny DeVito in it, you know, like a sort of career reviving role. And it's dry, it's ironic, it's the sort of thing that people often think Americans are incapable of, but but actually they are, because you can get all sorts of things in America. You can get total irony failure and very, very nuanced irony. And it's gone for a very long time. And there's a famous episode where they put on a musical. I think it's called The Nightman Cometh, and it's got this very, very catchy song in it, which I'm sure has got Gnostic, Luciferian connections. It's Day Man, Slayer of the Night Man, and it goes on like this. And so they put on this musical for whatever reason, and this musical is they all want to get their hands on this little boy, and one of the characters says, one of the actresses play, she's uncomfortable about this role that she's been given in the musical, because it seems to her that she is essentially endorsing paedophilia, and she's bullied into, you know, if you want this role, you can't quibble with the lines, you've just got to deal with it. Okay. And I thought this was a fantastic revelation of the method for really what people who want to get on in Hollywood or want to get on in that world have to do. They have to participate in these occult rituals, disgusting behavior, because that is how you become an initiate. So what was happening in Shakespeare, this sort of revelation of the method in things like something like Dream, is happening now in contemporary American comedy. because nothing changes, really. They use the same methods over and over again.
I you broke up a little bit there, but I 100% agree with you. Yeah, it's everywhere. It's shocking. It really is.
One more thing. You were talking about Apuleius and donkeys and stuff.
Yeah.
If ever you get the chance, do not ever watch this art movie that I watched, a Polish movie called E-O, or capital E, capital O. And it's all about a donkey. And it's weird. And I'm going to ruin it for you, so you don't have to watch
it. Yeah, good.
The donkey dies at the end. And I was very upset. And it's based on it was inspired by a classic Robert Bresson movie called Azar Balthazar, which apparently is, you know, but the Eto, don't go and watch Eto. I think that was all I wanted to say about that. One more thing. I almost got the character's name right in Titus Andronica. It's Lavinia.
Lavinia, right.
Lavinia, who gets her tongue cut out.
Don't watch Titus Andronicus. Oh, my God.
It's horrible, but kind of gory fun. I mean, watching it from our awake perspective, it's a much tougher watch.
Well, here's the thing. Watch Shakespeare with a conspiracy eye and watch it knowing that a very high-level aristocrat wrote it, a very high-level initiate into the mysteries wrote it, and he wrote it for various reasons. The history plays are all very pro-monarchy and pro-Tudor, of course, when it gets to there. But yeah, watch it with that eye and see what you see. It's incredible.
Yeah. Well, I think that when you realize, or as we've surmised, that these courtiers were actually engaging. I wouldn't be surprised if they were engaging in things like not just paedophilia and bestiality, but child sacrifice, because it's what the elites do. It's kind of part of their ritual requirements, is it not?
Well, you could go there with Midsummer Night's Dream because the little boy disappears.
The ending of Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah. He disappears. You never see him, and then he disappears. Like, why hasn't he joined Oberon's gang, as Oberon so desperately wanted him for? And also, Romeo and Juliet, those are children. And if you listen to the podcast, I have a pretty thorough article. The podcast is better, but, you know, you do these deep readings, you have to go into detail because they're little, as they now call them, Easter eggs hidden throughout the play that add up to a secondary narrative running through the play. And I think I found child sacrifice in Macbeth. Do we have time for that?
Where do you find it?
In Macbeth.
No, whereabouts in Macbeth?
At the very end, when, of course, the hero of Macbeth is? I'm asking you that question, James.
Yeah, I know, but you could be, because I've been dwelling on Always Sunny and now and Midsummer. The hero of Macbeth is Macduff.
The English army.
Oh, my God.
Macduff is a scumbag who abandons his family for no good reason. And he's purportedly the hero, but he's actually a slime ball. And critics have pointed this out, that it's a nihilistic play. There are no heroes. Well, the hero is the English army. The English army has just won the war. They invade Scotland to restore order. It's a playbook for expanding empire. You mind control an assassin, kill the king, start a civil war. You know, we're going to do them a favor and invade the country and restore order. And that's what happens, but nobody really notices. And there's one other good person to play, and that's Edward the Confessor, a famous English king, the only English saint king who was sainted. And they mention him briefly in a scene that's not in the Roman Polanski version, where Macduff goes to England and gathers an army. So Macduff abandons his family and goes to England to raise up an army with Duncan's kids, one of the kids. The kids just run away, by the way. Their father gets killed, and they're like, we better run away. Like, they're cowards.
I think we can assume they're going to get killed, don't we?
They don't. They don't. In fact, one of them...
Offstage. No?
Offstage, they don't. They one goes to Ireland. You never hear from him again. And right. The other rides back with Macduff and the English army.
Oh,
it's
right.
Described as the English army, but it's Northampton who's a big hero. Northumberland. He's a big hero. I think it's Northumberland. I get Northampton and Northumberland confused. Northumberland.
More likely to be Northumberland, I'd have thought.
It's Northumberland. And they finally face Macbeth. And who runs in to face Macbeth first? Northumberland's son. He's a teenage boy. And he runs in, and Macbeth just dispatches him with ease. And finally, Macduff comes in, the fake hero of the play. He's the hero because he kills Macbeth, but he's a real lowlife. That comes out, by the way, in the scene Polanski leaves out. When he goes to England, there's a really crazy scene where he tries to convince Duncan's son to come back and be king. I won't go into it. It's a riot. It's so goofy and weird. It's so nihilistic. And discussion of kingship, so nihilistic. And then Macduff kills Macbeth. And then they're talking about it. Macbeth is dead, his head is on a pike, and they're chatting, you know, about the battle, as we men do, and the adventure, what just happened. And Northumberland goes, I can't think of a better way for that boy to die. You know, like, they just shoved him in to be killed. He was an idiot. Like, no father would let his son run up and fight Macbeth, the greatest fighter. You know, this Macbeth is just slaughtered, like facing Beowulf. He's just slaughtered, you know, hundreds of people. And they just, yep, that was a great death. Oh, my boy, I'm so proud of him. And it really smacks me as a sacrifice.
Yeah. Well, there is, of course, that thing about the nobility and the ritual sacrifice of their firstborn.
Yep.
They love it.
Yep. They pay their, you know, they get their bona fides.
They do.
Yeah. That's how it's done. I think it's a rumor, but I think it's real. It's definitely real.
Well, you know, it's either that or they have to bring them up as the opposite sex.
There's that now. You got to do something. Yeah.
When you think about it, you think about the gender, the cross-gender stuff in Shakespeare. They're always experimenting with
LGBTQ loves Shakespeare. There's 7 plays out of 36 that prominently feature cross-dressing. There's lots of androgyny in Shakespeare and the poems, and Southampton was really girlish looking when he was a teenager, and they celebrate that. And of course it's in the sonnets. And it turns out that's a big part of alchemy, was like turning a man into a woman and a woman into a man would kind of prove you were God. You had the real power. You had the philosopher's stone. And you'll find it throughout. And that really shocked me. I mean, that's all a part of Gnosticism and alchemy, like to deny any reality that Creator had, you know, that there's two sexes, you know, invert every reality of Creator so that you're the new Creator. You're taking over.
Robert, just very briefly, before we go, the year zero of the world that we inhabit now,
yeah,
wasn't necessarily sort of the Elizabethan court and Francis Bacon, was it? I mean, they were merely using ideas which had been around since forever.
Yeah, Bacon was a great a combiner of ideas. You can always find somebody he took the idea from. In fact, most of the Shakespeare plays are somebody else's idea, the plot. But I think his original idea was social alchemy in terms of theater in a big way, in a really big way. And of course, Freemasonry is ultimately alchemy. It's a type of individual social alchemy where you change yourself, you know, doing ritual. And I think that's his very original idea. And then he split alchemy in, from the physical side, where they really are in a laboratory, in a cauldron, you know, cooking things and seeing what they get. And he saw that as too random. And he said, look, guys, you got to gather data. You got to really observe things and gather data and write it down and look at it and think about it. And he cleaned up alchemy, and he put the mystical side of alchemy into Freemasonry. And you'll find famous Freemasons, you know, Albert Mackey, he'll say like Freemasonry is basically alchemy. They're very, very similar. And then Gnosticism takes in every single religion, Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, Judaism, Platonism, Kabbalah, Egyptian religion, Adonis, you know, all that stuff, Tammuz and Ishtar and Adonis. That's the whole Venus and Adonis, why he starts Shakespeare off with Venus and Adonis, because Adonis is so important symbolically. In fact, I think Hiram Abiff is Adonis. I've got a book here by a Freemason. It's super deep about how this dying and rising Hiram Abiff, the architect of the temple, is another Adonis, and he really details this quite brilliant. And so Shakespeare starts with Venus and Adonis.
Do you think what one of the few prominent name critics of Shakespeare was Tolstoy?
And yeah, I did a whole episode on that. Yeah, go ahead.
Tolstoy was not a Freemason, was he?
No.
He was kind of anti.
He was a very devout Christian. He kind of went a little too far at the end.
Oh, yeah. He got excommunicated.
He gave away all his land. Yeah, because he was criticizing the church. He wanted to give away all of his land. He just wanted to be a hermit. And his wife was like, yo, we still have six kids or whatever. Like, Leo.
Have you read his last book?
How Much Land Does a Man Need? That one?
His final big novel, which was a huge success in America, bigger, much more successful than War and Peace.
No, what's it called?
Let me look up what it's called. Tolstoy. I recommend it. It's a good read. Tolstoy.
Those Ruskies, they're amazing.
Oh, they are. They're fantastic.
Chekhov is the man.
Resurrection.
Really? Yeah, I didn't know about that.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. I will. I'm going to make a note of that.
Sienni. It's interesting. So he was the only really
only one.
Big name dissenter, wasn't he?
Only one. There's the philosopher, the Austrian philosopher, Ludwig Wittgenstein. But he didn't write a treatise about it. He just said it a few times. And that's enough to cause like anxiety and, you know, flapping of wings in the Shakespeare crowd. Like, how could Wittgenstein not have liked Shakespeare? What is it? We must explain this.
And what was Tolstoy's main objection?
He just came out and called Shakespeare evil.
Right. That's cool. This is why I love Tolstoy. He's just like, he's cool.
He's very direct. And he goes into a long put down of King Lear. He concentrates on King Lear.
Okay. I'm going to have to read this.
Oh, it's funny. It's short. It's like 50, 60 pages. What's it called? Maybe 100. He coupled it up with somebody else's criticism of Shakespeare from more of a socialist point of view. Which is also true, which is the only other guy who criticized Shakespeare, but also praised him, was the Irish socialist playwright Shaw. What,
Bernard Shaw?
Yeah, he would say because Shakespeare doesn't offer any solutions, and he does. He rips the common man.
Oh, like horrible. Like, Shaw is just kind of Fabian monster.
But he's so I don't count him because he also praised Shakespeare. You know who praised Shakespeare strangely was Orwell. And he kind of jumped down Tolstoy's throat, which I don't get, because the other play I half analyzed, I didn't spend months on it, which they need, was Taming of the Shrew, which is a total humiliation ritual mind control where Caterina winds up telling Petruchio the sun is the moon.
Yeah.
The moon is the sun. Oh, he did. Yeah. So it's like Tolstoy, that's 2 + 2 = 5. I mean, Orwell. That's 2 + 2 = 5, dude. Like, how did you miss that?
Yeah.
Kind of weird. I mean, I don't know. What do you think of Orwell? Is he totally legit?
I've got my doubts about Orwell. I love the writing attributed to him, but I'm
suspicious.
The Sheep Farm podcast has been good on Orwell. They say there's stuff about him that just doesn't add up.
Yeah, I guess we shouldn't change topics.
I'm so glad that despite your terrible insults that you chat at me, I managed to lure you back onto the pod, because I do enjoy our chats, and I think you're very erudite. Tell us where we can find your stuff and read you and hear you.
So I'm at thehiddenlifeisbest.com. Everything is there. But a lot of the essays are on Substack and Patreon at The Hidden Life is Best. And most of them are free. Some of the really deep dive podcasts are behind a monthly subscription paywall of only $5. I could use some monthly subscribers, some more. I'd love to hire a research assistant. I'm working on a book. I just decided to shorten the book because I could research this for the rest of my life between the empire and science, because I got into this because of scientism, and I do believe Bacon invented scientism. But I got to get a book out. I think I'm just gonna focus on Romeo and Juliet for the Shakespeare. And subscribe, listen to some of the secret podcasts of the deep dives into Macbeth, Hamlet. The Tempest is really crazy. And that's where Aldous Huxley got Brave New World from, the title that's in The Tempest, and the island. It takes place on an island. But yeah, check my stuff out. You'll find my email if you have any questions. And thanks for listening. James, thanks for having me. That's very impressive of you after what I said to have
that's
me
right.
on.
I really recommend Robert's stuff. It's really interesting. So congratulations on all your work.
Thank you, sir.
And I hope you don't still think I'm I like the idea that I might be a chaos agent. chaos agent. I don't think I am. It's been great talking to you. Everyone, thank you for your support, especially those of you who are, I love my paid subscribers. You can buy me a coffee if you want to, or you can try going to my website, jamesstellingpole.co.uk. Support my sponsors. Love you all. See you all soon. Bye-bye. There is now a new, better way of supporting me. If you want to, you can now subscribe direct at jamesdellingpole.co.uk. It's now got new features where you can subscribe directly to me. You get access to all my old archive material. You get my podcasts as they come out. And you can comment on the podcast, and you can communicate with me probably more directly than you can elsewhere. I think it's probably the best way forward. Also, it obviates the risk of my being suddenly randomly closed down by some of these other websites. I mean, they're not our friends. So if you want to support me direct, go to jamesdellingpole.co.uk and sign up there. Without your support, I wouldn't be able to do what I do. So thank you.
Support ridiculously honest, no holds barred, independent truth-seeking at jamesdellingpole.co.uk. The Delling Pod is produced by Wolfish Limited. Guests are very kindly booked by the lovely Venetia. The show is edited by Andrew Warwick, with animation by Warwick A.